Blog Talk Radio.
Republicans, i.e. health care. To hear more about this and to listen to our creed, here is our brother Ralph. But before doing so, I want to salute Brother Larry, Sister Ann, and Brother Tom, and we're expecting more guests to join us shortly. Brother Ralph Pointer.
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. What I believe, the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. And the lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. Now, we know this is a program dedicated to freeing our political prisoners, because our political prisoners are the people who saw the problem and worked to solve the problem beyond crying, weeping and wailing, and gnashing of teeth. They went out and worked on our behalf to save our lives, to save our futures. And they are in jail. Many are in jail. Many have died in jail. And you heard my credo, what I live by. And we're going to tell you stories, give you facts, to talk about what will help you understand these conclusions. Now, this past week, We are going to talk about the issue that just brought the Democratic Party down. And this is health care. Now, if you remember, when people start talking about single-payer health care, over 70% of the American population, Democrats, Republicans, and everyone else, over 70% wanted single-payer health care. Mr. Obama, ex-President Obama, promised single-payer health care, which helped take him over the top in terms of the electoral process, and the fact that he was black, a person of color. Liberals felt happy voting for him. The corporations who knew that he was going to take it off the table the moment that he became president, the moment that he was elected, he was going to take it off the table. They were sure of it. He was in their bag, and every astute, let me say it again, every astute political observer knew it and told everyone about it. And our brother Larry Pinkney was one of those people. I include myself as being one of those people who understood that Obama was ghetto insurance. He would silence the total left, the total progressive community, black and white. And here we are, 8 years later, he did that. But in the process of doing that, he destroyed the Democratic Party because they thought that they had a lock on the minds, the hearts and minds of the American people, and they didn't have to listen to those. That 74% wanted single-payer health care. And they also knew that Bernie Sanders was not in their pocket, and that when he said single-payer health care, he meant it. And so the Democratic Party, I believe it is possible that the Democratic Party cut out more votes than the Republican Party. That is, those people who were voting for Bernie Sanders' votes were cut out. They were denied their right to vote. And the count all over the country was manipulated, and the Democratic Party got the leaders of the Democratic Party got the candidate they wanted, and that was Mrs. Clinton. But the people were not behind Hillary Clinton, and therefore Donald Trump won. But all of the polls showed that Donald Trump had a chance and possibly could beat Hillary, and all of the polls also showed that Donald Trump didn't have a chance against Bernie Sanders. But the leaders of the Democratic Party, who are in lockstep with corporate America, wanted to have Hillary. And they would rather risk running Hillary in a neck-and-neck campaign than having a candidate like Bernie Sanders falsely accused of being a socialist as the candidate for the party. A sure win that the Democratic Party rejected for hopeful win with somebody who would toe the corporate line. And the issue was the rich having everything and the poor having nothing, the 1% versus the 99%. It has been phrased in many different ways. But the thing that people understood and the thing that came close to their hearts and we confront every day is health care. Mm-hmm. And this was the one that the Democratic Party fluffed, muffed, and it cost them. And so now we're in a situation where things are happening faster than light speed. But it's the same thing over and over and over again. And let me give you a few things in a few minutes that's going to make you understand or help you understand what my credo is all about. Now, this Sunday at the New York Times, there was an article about a situation that was happening in Louisiana. And this situation could be, you didn't need to know the name of the town. It could be happening in so many parts of America. And this is the story of a Louisiana sheriff who was a typical Southern sheriff. And was Iberia, Louisiana. And his police force ran roughshod over the black community, killing, beating, terrorizing, etc. And finally, the government, through a lot of petitioning and a lot of political activity, had the federal government, that is, had to come in and take a look at this. And finally, after many of the people who worked for the sheriff saved their own bacon by letting it out, testifying against this murderous, corrupt sheriff. And they testified for safety or for forgiveness of their own crimes. They testified against the sheriff. But to make a long story short, it happens over and over again. The sheriff was not found guilty. No one was found guilty of anything. And black people are dying. Now I'm going to digress to a story that is related. Bear with me. Recently, one of the organizations in New York City, Spartacist organization, that fundraised for political prisoners, had a fundraising event, and progressive people were asked to speak. And one of the people asked to speak was from the Angola 3, one of the three gentlemen who had spent 25 to 30 years in prison. And he told his story. And the part of the story I would like to relate to you is that he said in 1962 he came to New York City. That was the same year I came to New York City. And what he saw in New York City, for the first time in his life, he was from Louisiana, near New Orleans. For the first time in his life, he saw black men who were not afraid. He saw black men who were not afraid. He saw members of the Black Panther Party. And so what can we conclude from that? We can conclude that black people all over the South and much part of the North were terrorized, were frightened in their everyday life, just living and walking. And so many of us who were drawn to resist self-defense because it was an age where it was no longer acceptable to lay down for the police, to lay down for this racist society, to obey Jim Crow laws, to fight back, fight fire with fire. And so we see today, all over the country, it continues. Black people are being killed by the army of occupation called the police. Those who understood and fought back, those who were not afraid, many are dead, as in war, people die, and many are in jail. And our job is to have those folks who fought for us released and to demand from our so-called misleadership class, that is the politicians, that we have the power in our hands to put them in office and take them out. And one of the methods that we must use, those who believe in the vote, we must use that as the Puerto Rican community and our brothers and sisters in the Puerto Rican community freed all of their political prisoners, and Oscar Lopez Rivera will be among us in a few months because the people that he supported him. And we must do the same. We must do the same. Or we must recognize that we did not deserve their energy and their support of our issues. And with that, I'm going to let others come in and discuss the issue of health care, the problems that we have in our community, and the problems that they are working on. So I'm going to pass the mic to Betty Davis.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. I thought you were also going to speak about the sheriffs, the corrupt sheriffs, who kept stealing what they considered contraband from black people's houses, and they started doing it to such a large extent that the black people finally stood up and reported them, and the government had to investigate that as well. What we're looking at is decay and corruption, total corruption, as well as oppression. Before I introduce our next host, I want to acknowledge that Brother Tom and Sister Ann and Brother Joel are in the house. And I want to say about the next speaker that in 2008, he wrote an article which said, "An Obama presidency, more of the same, only worse." And what he commented on is that the ability of Obama to put people to sleep by saying one thing and doing another, and his role with the corporate media to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, engaged in relentless, ruthless, and absolutely unprecedented campaign of corporate branding and marketing on behalf of Barack Obama, with the peoples of the United States as their target. And he goes on to say, the media successfully installs their favorite choice for the Democratic Party, and that was the Republican, Barack Obama. I want to remind you that he also said the peoples of the world will face intensified imperialistic and military assault and attempts at U.S. hegemony. This is the brother who is a former political prisoner who freed himself as per Jahlil Montequin. And I am referring to none other than Black Panther Larry Pinckney.
Larry, I just want to say not only did he free himself, but he was very instrumental in keeping it going along with his wife, keeping the struggle going to free Lynn Stewart. Larry, are you in the house?
I am in the house, my dear brother and comrade. Oh, you know, I am feeling chills right now. Sister Betty, you blew my mind, sister. You just blew my mind. Because we had not talked, and at least before this program, and I'll be damned, you referred to the very article that I was going to refer to regarding none other than the Republicrats, and in this instance, Barack drone man, you know, doublespeak Obama. And the article that you referred to, of course, came out well before drone man, Republican slash Democrat slash black, in heavy quotation marks, Obama came out well before he was installed as the imperialistic leader, the black face on imperialism. The article actually came out in October, as I think you may have mentioned, Sister Betty. You know what, Sister Betty, forgive me. I always, you know, and I want to say to the audience, I have such deep respect for Brother Ralph, Sister Lynn, and Sister Betty. And it's very difficult for me because every time I say Sister Betty, I always want to say Betty Shabazz. But we're not talking about Sister Betty Shabazz. We're talking about Sister Professor Betty Davis, who has been in this struggle for decades. So I just want to say thank you, Sister. It's as if you're reading my mind. Lord, it's as if you're reading my mind. I want to begin simply by saying thank you. I'm looking forward, as always, to hearing from Sister Ann Lamb, Brother Tom, Brother Joel, and all of our other guests. And, of course, need I mention or say our dear, dear Sister Lynn Stewart. Let me begin by quoting the words of Brother Frederick Douglass. You know, Frederick said that where justice is denied, where poverty is enforced, where ignorance prevails, and where any one class is made to feel that society is an organized conspiracy to oppress, rob, and degrade them, neither persons nor property will be safe, unquote. Frederick Douglass. I think we're seeing that more and more, or we're seeing this more and more today. But I want to quickly jump over to what Sister Professor Betty Davis said. And she was referring to an article that I wrote well before, back in October of 2008, well before Obama, the Obamatron, was installed. The article is entitled, "An Obama Presidency, More of the Same, Only Worse." And it was originally published in the Black Commentator, and you can still find it. Just put it in. But my point is, let's not, you know, dangle on that. Let's move on. I want to pick out a couple of things, because Brother Ralph and Sister Betty, and I'm sure others will refer to it, but both of them have referred to health care. And, of course, if we have sufficient health care, the vast majority of our problems in this society, in this nation, would be cured if we had right there that one common denominator. Now, I want to just pick out a couple of things very quickly, if you, the audience, and I want to thank the audience for listening and looking forward to hearing from all of them as well. I just want to pick out a couple of things that I wrote, and I want you to think about it, please. I said, and I'm just picking out pieces, I said, in relative short order, inside the United States, under a Barack Obama presidency, the living conditions of the majority of black, white, brown, red, and yellow peoples will continue to steadily and massively deteriorate, while the corporate Wall Street barons prolong their glut of the everyday people's finances, resources, hopes, and dreams. I went on to say that under an Obama presidency, those non-blacks who stand in opposition to Barack's, Obama's de facto pro Wall Street backers and their blood-sucking policies, why, they will be branded as racist and traitors. While those blacks who oppose Obama's policies will be ignored and or branded as fringe radicals and traitors. Thus, the horrors of the U.S. empire will continue unabated, and in many respects, under Barack Obama, actually will worsen. The blame for the deteriorating economy and continued war will, of course, be quickly laid by the Obama-Biden regime and the Democratic Party Republicans on the previous Bush-Cheney regime, despite the fact that it was the complicity of the Democratic Party itself with the Bush-Cheney Republican-Republicrat regime that facilitated the despicable policies and practices of the Bush-Cheney regime. The fact is that Democrats and Republican parties are de facto Republicrats with the objective of doing what? Of exploiting the majority of people and maintaining U.S. empire abroad. And I might add, not just abroad, but first and foremost at home, to exploit us, to divide us, to keep us ignorant, as Brother Frederick Douglass had said. Ignorance. And I refer, and I'm going to end very quickly, but I refer to the words of Brother Malcolm X, El-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, who said, quote, "I believe that there will ultimately be a clash between the oppressed and those who do the oppressing. I believe that there will be a clash between those who want freedom, justice, and equality for everyone and those who want to continue the system of exploitation. I believe that there will be that kind of clash, but I don't think it will be based on the color of the skin." Unquote. Malcolm X, El-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz. The Democratic Party, of course, you know, Malcolm correctly referred to them, and others as well, it wasn't just Brother Malcolm, referred to them as what they are, Dixiecrats. I wonder sometimes today in the year 2017 if they have not completely lost their minds. They seem to want a thermonuclear holocaust, which no one can win, with the Russian Federation. They seem to want to ignore their complicity with a system that has been endlessly oppressing, endlessly emaciating, endlessly tearing apart our communities, black, white, brown, red, yellow, across the board in this nation that we call America. So I also want to end, or I simply want to end, by saying that when it comes right down to it, our political prisoners, must be free. Brother Ralph mentioned Brother Lopez of the Puerto Ricans. Huh? Show you right. Because the Puerto Ricans had the wherewithal, the integrity, the honor to come together and say, "You will free our political prisoner." Isn't it about time that we come together as a people, beginning with black people, so-called African Americans, come together and say, "You will free our political prisoners." And it's not just black. We're also talking about Leonard Peltier, our brother, Leonard Peltier, indigenous native brother. We're talking about our other brothers and sisters, whether it's Seth Hayes, etc. But let me stop. I become very passionate about this because, as Brother Ralph pointed out, this program is dedicated to the freeing of our political prisoners. we as a people, we as people, much less a people, we as people, as human beings, must recognize our responsibility to free our political prisoners and therefore to free ourselves. I'm going to end right here and right now. I want to thank you, Sister Betty Davis, Sister Professor Betty Davis. Thank you, Brother Ralph. Looking forward to Sister Ann, Brother Tom, Brother Joel, and, of course, Sister Lynn Stewart. All power to the people. Free them all. Free them now. Work on it. The struggle continues. A luta continua. All power to the people. Thank you.
As thank you for that, and as our brother chairman, Fred Hampton Jr., says, what's the call? Free them all. Betty Davis.
All right. Before we go to Sister Ann, I want to introduce our brother, Tom, and I want to make Tom burst out in hysterical laughter. I got an email from Senator Jesse Hamilton, and he has suddenly discovered that the broken windows policy policing is not working and that it's time to end this practice. I can't help but chuckle and wonder if black people, including white people, had continued to try to go with the Democrats no matter what, if he would finally have come around to a reality which you knew all along, and you were sending out emails demanding that we organize to end this practice. Tom, I thank you because I remember when your article came out about the broken windows policy, and it shows that the Democrats are not leading anything. That, as usual, they're the caboose in the train. So, Brother Tom, are you in the house?
Yes, I am. My greetings to all my brothers and sisters on this call. You know, Brother Ralph begins almost every program, if not every program, every week, with the statement that the only time black lives mattered was really during slavery, when they could be super exploited and not getting paid for it. And this, of course, created an aristocracy of slave owners with their plantations. Now, we're taught to believe that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. But we know that if we study history carefully, this was not the case. The southern states, when Abraham Lincoln got elected, realized that even though he said he was not going to end slavery, they knew that they were losing control of the country, and eventually slavery probably would have to be ended. So they decided to go for it and secede from the Union. And during the Civil War, before Abraham Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation, the Union Army invaded the South, and every time the Union troops got near slave plantations, tens of thousands of slaves just left the plantation and went over into the Union lines. Now, this created a problem. What was the Union Army going to do? Are they going to return the slaves to the rebel states, to their enemies now? They couldn't do that. So the blacks, in effect, were freeing themselves. And Abraham Lincoln knew that the situation had gotten to the point that he had to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which only freed the slaves in the rebellious states, did not free the slaves where slavery was still legal in the border states. And then after the Civil War, there was a huge problem. Now, what is this nation going to do, particularly in the South, with a population of freed slaves who are no longer slaves? How is their labor going to be controlled and super exploited? So the slavocrats decided to enact black codes and to actually reinstitute slavery on their plantations. And they had an unexpected thing that happened, where before the Civil War, only was it 3/8 of a slave was counted for representation in the federal government, in the House of Representatives.
Tom, I believe it was 3/8, but it doesn't change anything. 3/5. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what happened after the Civil War? Now there were no slaves. So now all of the freed blacks now were counted, but of course they had no vote immediately after the Civil War. So this gave the former slave states more of an opportunity to exert their influence in Congress. Well, after this bloody Civil War, the Northern Republicans could not allow that. So they passed civil rights legislation, which supposedly assured the freed slaves the right to vote, the right of civil liberties. And of course, in order to enforce this, they had to send the federal army into the South to reconstruct the South and assure that now the freed slaves would vote Republican, and that would assure their control over our national government. Well, that started in 1868. We know what happened 10 years later. The northern states, the Republican Party, tired of forcing civil rights and the equal vote onto the southern states. So they made a compromise. They would let southern whites get control of the southern states again, let them intimidate the black population, withdraw the federal army, and then we get the situation that stayed for another 100 years, in which the blacks essentially were disenfranchised. Now let's go to
an interruption, Tom. Slavery by
yes.
another name, but continue.
Yes.
Slavery by another name.
Jim
continue,
Crow
Tom.
Became slavery by another name. Now let's go 100 years after that to 1968. Bobby Kennedy was running for president, and he made a statement that most so-called liberal whites thought was quite audacious. He said that blacks were making a lot of progress, and that probably within 40 years, or around 2008, we may even have a black president. Now, I just saw a movie I highly recommend about the life of James Baldwin called I Am Not Your Negro. And I recommend that movie. It's playing in the city now at the Walter Reed Theater. And Baldwin said that the white liberals may have thought this was an audacious statement, but many progressive blacks didn't think that way. What Bobby Kennedy was saying as he was running for president is, if you blacks behave yourself, then in 40 years, you may enjoy the same privileges, including becoming president, as the whites. People weren't thinking in those terms. Certainly the whites weren't. And so now we have a situation. Now, a question was posed in that movie by Baldwin, which was, what is it? What is it about the whites in this country, by and large, which has made them such a vicious, exploitative race? What is it about us? I'm a white man. I recognize this. We all suffer from some degree of racism. Most of us are in denial. Some of us recognize it. Most of us, many of us actually not only deny, don't deny it, they say, yes, we are racist. Blacks have to be kept down. We are superior. What is it about our history as the white race? Baldwin poses this question. And until whites begin to think about this seriously, before whites face their own history, what is it in our past, our history, our religion, our culture? What is it that we brought over from Europe? What is it that we established here in the so-called New World, which has made our race, by and large, a vicious, exploitative race? That's the question that whites must ask themselves. We must face up to it, because if we don't, then this nation is on the road to another civil war. And it won't be a war between the North and the South. It will be a war mainly between people of color with a few whites, hopefully more than a few, but I have to say, I have to agree with James Baldwin on this question. The majority of whites are not going to be able to deal with this. There's going to be the question will be solved, unfortunately, through another bloody struggle.
Well, thank you for that, Tom. And I'm going to refer now back to 1962 when Lynn Stewart began to understand. Lynn Stewart, the white teacher, the white librarian, the white lawyer, who began to understand the situation in America. And when she says, I believe that this next struggle, Ralph, will be between black people fighting for their rights against white people who want to oppress them to keep black people from having whites, and white people who will join the black people to give up white privilege. And I said, 1963, you understood that fantastically. You said it clearly. And Tom, you have said it again, because America, past and present, has been murder, torture, and every injustice against people who are not of a color and a gender. And I have to add, people who have no assets. As a friend of mine said once, what is going on here? I'm white and 21. What is going on? I'm an American. And my response to him was, how much money do you have in the stock market? Because if you have no money, your white and 21 does not matter. And with that said,
that's another question that James Baldwin posed in this movie I recommend, that until whites get over this thing about their own security and making money and put humanity, compassion, brotherhood first, then there is no salvation for this country.
May I say something?
It will end in a bloody struggle.
May I say something very quickly? I met James Baldwin, talked with him in 1968 at the on Montgomery Street in San Francisco at the Committee Theater, where a play called Big Time Buck White was being put on. Talked to him at length. Let us also understand that Jimmy said that the freedom of the white man will only come about with the freedom of the black man. And let me expand that by saying the freedom of all people, and of both genders, not just men, okay? And I really want to clarify something. I believe strongly in the struggles of people like Bobby Sands in Ireland. Uh-huh. I believe strongly in people like John Brown and his three sons. I believe strongly, as Brother Malcolm said, that this will be a conflict between not race, or color, but it will be a conflict based upon the economic realities that are being faced. And white folks in this nation are coming to terms, whether they like it or not, to the reality that economics is kicking them too in their posterior. And let us also understand that slavery was an economic, not just a psychological, but it was an economic condition. That's all. I'm sorry. I had to interject.
Thank you for that,
Thank
Larry.
You.
And it's one of the things of the movement of the 60s and 70s and the 30s in America was an injustice to one is an injustice to all. Betty Daly.
I want to turn the mic now over to our sister Ann, and I want everybody to recognize that Joel has an important discussion that he's going to be presenting to us this evening, and we want to be sure to leave time for that. And I know, however, that Sister Ann wants to give us an update on what's happening with Mamiya and the water in the prison, and Brother Seth and the health emergency, and last but not least, the brother who came home to us, the political prisoner who came home to us. Sister Ann, welcome back. We missed you last week.
Well, I missed you too last week. I was afraid that the Eastern District of New York was going to do that to me again. But they didn't today. I went to see Seth. I'm just going to start with Seth because I just saw Seth on Sunday. Now, the previous Sunday, February 4th, was when he had the incident where he fell out in the shower, right, which was fairly serious. So I went to see him on Sunday. We had an excellent visit despite, as I say, the current dire circumstances. The giant lump on his head has subsided. What happened was he went to take a shower and his sugars were so low and he fell in the shower. So he hit his head and they thought he might have fractured his skull again, since after he was captured back in 1973, the police actually fractured his skull in four different places while beating him up at the precinct. So he's sort of used to the fractured skull thing, but no, really, you know, it is very serious. So he has, it looks like they butterflied above his right eyebrow. They didn't actually stitch it. He has, like, probably three butterflies. He said they glued it together. I said, no, no, that's called a butterfly. They put it, hold it together and put a little bandage over it. It's called a butterfly. He said, okay. So he has, like, three butterflies. So what happens was he came to in the shower, and it's a pool of blood, you know, because he hit his head, and that's always a lot of blood with a head injury. And he doesn't really remember passing out. So they took him right away to the nearest outside hospital, which is some little hospital in a little town nearby, because they wanted to rule out the fractured skull, which was ruled out. But he did suffer a severe concussion, and he's still having headaches because of this. And he was kept in the so-called infirmary, as we call it, the so-called infirmary at Sullivan for 2 days, because being in the infirmary, as Seth says, is like being in a shoe. He's all by himself. Nobody else is there. There's two COs constantly present and no witnesses except for the nurses who do everything the COs tell them to. And he's also worried about the pump now because the medical personnel, if we can call them that at Sullivan, have told him that even if he gets this pump, he'll still need to be monitored 3 times a day. So this is leading him to think
that they're going to give him an insulin pump without a monitor, which is not what the endocrinologist at Coxsackie told him back in October. He wants the pump with the monitor because he can no longer tell when his sugars are high or low. And he feels that having an insulin pump without the monitor may actually worsen his current situation. So we're still doing the campaign. People can go to jerichony.org. That's jerichony.org. It's right up there on the front page. Call, write, and fax. All the information is there. There's more detail about the whole thing. We are demanding the immediate provision of the insulin pump sugar monitor. We are demanding that he receive a diabetic diet, not the false so-called diet, that they, the Class B diet that they use now, which is done by Carl J. Konigsman, M.D., so you can phone him, and you can fax him, and you can phone Annucci, and you can fax Annucci. He's the acting commissioner. And, of course, the governor, who needs to hear from us as well, since he is in charge of all this. And also, while you're up at jerichony.org, we have some important articles on or by our political prisoners. So there's a very good one by Susie Day, Visiting Political Prisoner Herman Bell in the Age of Trump. I would encourage people to read that. While he's on a visit, they're moving his possessions from one cell to another. Really disgusting stuff going on. Jaleel sends regards to everybody. I just got a letter from him. He's been given 14 days of good time off his shoe sentence. He's waiting to hear from Prisoner Legal Services in Buffalo. They were supposed to be writing a brief in support of his appeal. He also is trying to get in touch with his own lawyer for his own parole appeal. So I called him and left him a message this morning. Didn't talk to him, but hopefully we'll talk to him soon. And then the brother who was finally got out was our friend Zolo Azania. I have to say his supporters have been doing wonderful work for him. They've already raised $10,000 before he got out because they knew he was getting out.
Fantastic!
Yeah, that's great. They really did a good job. They started doing that back in December because they knew he was getting out in February. They didn't know exactly when, but they knew he would get out in February. He had his release date. He did 35 hard years. He did some of that on death row. Of course, it was the usual brouhaha. If you go and Google his name, you'll see all the, you know, cop killer released and the family of the cop saying he should never have been released and so on and so forth. And Zolo has always said he is not the person who killed my cop. You know, he's always maintained his innocence in that sense. So, you know, yet another case. But he's out.
And if he was or he wasn't, because he fought for freedom, and they are political prisoners of war. And
absolutely,
war
he is one of them. But, you know, I'm just saying, and like Leonard, you know, there are people who are, they are prisoners of war because it's been a war for more than 400 years. But Leonard Peltier, right, and Mumia Abu-Jamal, are two people who are clearly totally innocent of the crimes for which they were convicted, and they are not the only ones. The Move 9, clearly innocent of that crime. You know, and there are many people who actually are innocent, and there are many people who are not quote-unquote innocent, and we support them anyway. If anybody
I support
everybody. You don't have to be innocent for me to support you. In fact, if you're guilty, I might support you even more. You know, of what they say you did. You know, I mean, this is like in Ward Churchill's afterword to Jaleel's book, you know, Exiting the Prison, Fade to Black. He makes that excellent point, you know, about if people have killed for the community, you know, does that mean we should support them less? No. And that's like one of my arguments, as you've heard me say, back in these left forums going back that we've been doing for the past few years, in one of them I clearly said that some of our political prisoners receive less support from the community precisely because they did defend the community. And to me, that's just unconscionable. The community should be supporting them just as much as somebody who is obviously innocent. Innocence or guilt has nothing to do with it. It's your political positions is why you are there. And your political actions are why you are there. So whether or not you committed the so-called crime of which you were convicted, that does not matter to me, you know? I'm like, you know, these people are soldiers. The Black Liberation Army are soldiers. They are prisoners of war under every international, you know, consideration that there is. and they need our support, and they need our community support. At the same time, we're doing an ongoing thing up to Cuomo for Jaleel. The next Twitter storm for Jaleel is not this coming Wednesday, tomorrow, but next week. And that's also up on jerichony.org. And people, I don't tweet. I wrote a very long letter to the governor explaining all the reasons why Jaleel should have his sentence commuted to time served. So you don't have to tweet. You know, you can write, you can call. But we want the governor to hear every other Wednesday. The only thing that he hears on his phone all day long and the only thing he gets on his Twitter thing is Jaleel Muntakim, commutation of sentence to time served now.
Thank you so much for that, Ann.
Thank you.
And you have explained very clearly, dramatically, why we call them death camps and why we must free our political prisoners.
We must do it.
Are you in the house?
Hey, Joel.
Joel.
Yes.
Hello. Yes, hi.
Here he is.
Yes. Okay.
Promise to start off. We will let you start off. We will be honored to have you start off our program next week so that you can get your whole story in. But give us words of wisdom that you have for this week.
Yes, I think that in today's time of increased tension and I believe a great deal of confusion and a great deal of among the masses of people whose perspective is changing because its material conditions are changing, both among the oppressed communities of color and among the white working class, so-called, I say, because the working class itself is a multiracial class, and there is discrimination, but there is also there are also things in common. And it brings us to a situation where what we're facing in the long run and maybe the not-so-long run, something that's going on really all the time on a low level, but may escalate to a higher level at which it could lead to a high enough level to change the structure of governance in this country that is a revolution. Now, there are two perspectives really that come out. For example, when they pointed out that there was a shift of voting in the Electoral College, if we can believe the figures, they say that the white working class in certain states such as Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, Michigan, and Florida voted a certain way. They always saw that word white in there. And it's true that, of course, in the black community, Trump got votes in the one digits. They couldn't even make it into the two digits. But nevertheless, a lot of those white working class people are not voting on a racial basis. But the ruling class, by describing it in that way, is trying to give it more and more of a white identity rather than a working class identity. And there are those two perspectives, because in this country there could be a war, a race war, or a class war. And a lot of it depends on the leadership that is given to the people who are confused, who haven't made up their minds. And we have to, I think, agitate among the masses of people on that basis and to point out the things that can unite across racial lines, because I think within this particular system, one of the really terrible things about capitalism is that it doesn't create the conditions for people to overcome racism completely, especially white people, of course. They can't overcome it completely, and if we're going to have a revolution, we're going to probably have to have a lot of the masses of that revolution who are still moderately racist but who can put that in the second place after putting in the first place the
Gotta stop.
Next. Very.
Anyway, I guess I can point the clause, so I'll look.
You'll have to start next week, so you can explain.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thank you,
Thank
Ralph.
You.
Business will continue.
Say I'm clear for the whole round world to